Blog Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009, featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
Hey!
Thank you, bus people. A load of bus people sitting out there, and they're happy because we don't have any rain tonight. We missed last week because of a storm going through and knocked out electricity. And
yeah, but the temperature was like 101, and the stupid feels like temperature is like 150.
No, I know. It's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. Yeah.
I say that every week. Why don't they just tell us the temperature is 150? Don't tell me it's 93, you know, 100% humidity. It's 120. Just tell me it's 120.
Just say, it feels like 120. Drink lots of fluid. You know, I mean, that's, it makes more sense to me that way, too. Yeah, you're right. We have a guest tonight. Michael Evans, who is the CEO and co-founder of The Vines. I'm really looking forward to this because he started himself a club that is really quite unique. Yeah. So without further ado, and he's sitting there in the green room, I'm going to bring him out and into the show here. And welcome to the show, Michael. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, I just assumed it was you. you were sitting there, so I assumed it was you. You know, you heard me say that. You know, it's The Vines. It sounds. I've read some information about that, and that is really a cool concept. A cool everything. I was really impressed with all the stuff that you've done with that, and so. Instead of me just sitting here telling you how great it is, I'm going to let you tell us all about The Vines and how you tend to find it and everything. I'll just let you take over and start talking about it all now. So it's all yours.
Great. Well, The Vines is a membership club that travels around to different wine regions, and we work with our winemaking partners around the world to make wine. And we are our members are folks that love wine. They're passionate about wine. They've been drinking wine for a long time. Many of them are collectors. And this gives them an opportunity to go a bit deeper and dive in with our partners. And right now we've got partners in Napa, in Oregon, in Paso Robles, in Champagne, in Montalcino, the Mosel, and Champagne, and Priorat. And so basically what we give folks the opportunity to do is that we travel to one of these regions. We were last in Montalcino for 3 or 4 days, and we spent time making our own blends with Giacomo Neri from Casanova de Neri, one of the greatest makers of Brunello in the world. And he and his sons walked us through the process of tasting base wines, and then working with each of us to create our own wine that reflects our individual tastes, all with Sangiovese, of course, for the Brunello. And then we put them back in the barrels, and eventually, a year and a half later, they were bottled and labeled with each of our own individual labels, and they get shipped out to our members' homes. And so that's the kind of the crown jewel of what we do are these blending experiences and the opportunity for people to actually make their own blend, their own wines with these master winemakers around the world. But also when we go to a place like Tuscany, it's also about the group of people, the amazing members that we have that get together from all walks of life and spend a few days together. We also like to show people the insiders Tuscany or the insiders Champagne, and going to not the typical restaurants that you see in every guidebook, but the place that Giacomo and Roberto and the other our friends in Tuscany go with their families. And so you get a much more of a kind of an insider's look at what's going on in one of these regions.
Exciting. Okay, now, a bunch of questions. Number one, you said that your members make the wine and they take it home with them or they can share it with other members. Those are unique blends, I would think, right? I mean, those are just their own, oh, I like this, let me make this. It's not something that's going to be available to anybody anywhere except just for those people.
That's correct. And we work with entire barrel lots. So people will typically go in and have four or five different base wines. And then based on our preferences among those base wines, we'll blend them together in different proportions. And each member will end up with their own specific blend. And at the end of the day, end up with 25 cases of their own wine that's unique in the world.
Wow. that's great. Let's go back to the roots, to the beginning. How did you, where were you from originally, and how did you start this venture?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I had the good fortune to go to Argentina for what I thought was going to be a three-week vacation. That was 16 years ago, and basically I never left. I fell in love with Argentina and Mendoza. It is just a beautiful place. The people are wonderful. The wines are spectacular and very well priced. And it just felt like like Napa, not 10 or 20 years ago, but 50 or 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear to me that something was going to happen down there. And for me, my original idea, I was going to buy 5 or 10 acres of land and have my now business partner, Pablo and his family, who's been making wine and growing grapes for generations, have them take care of it. And I would go back to the States and then return to Argentina each year to blend and make the wine. And as soon as I started talking to my friends back in the States, they said, well, if you're going to do 5 or 10 acres, I want to as well. And then so the light bulb went off and said a lot of people out there have this dream of making their own wine and owning a small vineyard, but that may not have the financial resources to invest millions of dollars or just want to do it as something that's entertaining and not become a financial kind of business operation. And so we started in 2005. I'm looking for land. We looked at 76 different pieces of property before we finally found the one we fell in love with. We planted our grapes in 2007, which were ready to harvest first in 2010. So we built a winery so we could elaborate the wines for our owners. Then a few years later, as we grew and we had more than 100 owners from around the world at that point, we needed a place for them to stay. So we built a 5-star resort in the shadow of the Andes. Francis Malman, the very famous Argentine chef, it was our chef. And long story short, 16 years later, now we have 254 vineyard owners that each own between 1 and 20 acres in the shadow of the Andes, and they're making some phenomenal wines. Last year, we made 365 different wines with these owners just in Mendoza.
Wow. That's just amazing. That just astonishes me. Why has no one ever thought of this idea, this concept before? It seems so simple, but yet really fascinating. So you said that.
Well, in many ways, it's very similar to what's been happening in Burgundy for hundreds of years. You know, people have a row or two and they don't all own a tractor, or back then they didn't all own a horse. They would share, and it would be a co-op kind of model for people to be able to do it. And so, you know, taking some cues from there, and also part of it's financial. In Mendoza, the cost of an acre is a fraction of what it would be in Napa or Montalcino or Champagne or something. So that made it a little more economically possible as well.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. Now, I noticed on your list here, you said winemaking partners. We've got Italy, Germany, Spain, Argentina, California, France, Willamette Valley in the United States. Are these vineyards in these places? Or are they people who have interest in the one in Mendoza? What is the connection here?
So in Mendoza, in the vines of Mendoza, our owners actually own a piece of land, anywhere between 1 and 20 acres. That's their land that we farm on their behalf, and then we make wines with them when it comes time to harvest. And our expansion, so one of the things we realized, like wine lovers, like I'm sure for you, we're always looking for a new wine, a new region, something, try something new, try something different. And we've been looking around for many years to see how could we go and make wine in other parts of the world. And what we realize is there's a lot of phenomenal winemakers all over the world that are making wine, and many of them are interested in sharing their wine, their passion. And so partnering with people like Giacomo Neri in Montalcino, or Michelle and Charlene Drapier in Champagne, Jeff and Tony at Hourglass in Napa, very, very high-end, very famous wineries, and they love the ability to work with our members on creating their own blends. They get surprised sometimes with some of the ideas. They're kicking around in the winery with these passionate people, because what you end up with are people who are fans of these wines and fans of these regions, and very passionate about it and very knowledgeable. So for these winemakers who spend most of their time in the winery and in the vineyards making their wine, for them to spend some time with these really passionate people and educated people about wine, that want to learn from them is a real joy for them.
No, that would make sense. I mean, it's a win-win, I guess, on that, because the people will help the winemakers with ideas that they might not come up with themselves. So that's an interesting concept. Now, how did you get a hold of all these different regions and all these different people? I mean, obviously you just said your passion was Mendoza in Argentina. These are places all over the world. What attracted you to each one, or did they contact you, or what happened on this?
No, we seek them out. I mean, these are regions that, that we, and are among our members, think are important. I mean, it's kind of a mix of traditional blue chip places like Champagne and Montalcino and Napa, but also some more emerging markets not under the radar, but kind of places that are a little more creative, less traditional, like Priorat here in Spain, or Paso Robles in California, or even Mendoza. And so we basically reached out to regions and winemakers that we appreciate. We look for people who are farm sustainably, organically, lots of times biodynamically, people that respect the land, people that create phenomenal wines and are great people to be around. And we've spent basically over the last 16 years while we've developed the business in Argentina, traveling around and meeting people. And I think we developed a good reputation on what we built in Mendoza. And people took our calls, and we sat down and had some lunch and had some wine with people. And once we explained the concept, I think it was people really got excited about it. And of course, it led one after another. I mean, when you get people, very famous people like Giacomo Neri from Casanova Neri, or the Drapier from Champagne Drapier, that makes it easy. It gives you a calling card when you've got great winemakers already in the program.
Yeah, well, that would make you name dropping, and they go, oh yeah, I know them.
Exactly.
Are you looking at doing...
It's a relatively small community.
I'm sorry.
It's a relatively small community. I mean, people know each other, and even if they're in a different region or different country or different continent, the good winemakers know and drink wine from different parts of the world.
And also, people in the wine business are very open and willing to share and talk about what they do too. I've noticed that over the years doing this program, and even when I had a small winery here in Florida, people are always willing to help others and referred to it and all that. So that's always a good thing, I think. Are you looking for other areas, other winemaking partners? Are you going to stop it at this? Are you just going to get bigger and bigger? What's your future hope?
Well, we're not going to. I mean, we're going to continue to expand. We're always looking for the right partner. We're not in any hurry. We've got plenty of places to make wine. But each year we go and we meet with some new winemakers and check out some new regions. This year we'll be looking in the country of Georgia. We'll be going to Croatia. We spent some time last year in Piemonte, in Burgundy, New Zealand. So we're definitely looking for new partners. The Rhone is high on our list in France. So we're always keeping our eyes open for new opportunities.
Yeah, there's a lot of regions around the world. Some of them you just mentioned there that I think would fit well into your program. I was going to ask something there and I forgot what it was. Oh, well, okay. I want to back up a little bit here. When we first were contacted about you, it said that you had worked for many years as a campaign manager and on presidential campaigns through the years. That is quite a difference between that and jumping into making wine. The transition seems odd to me.
It was a big transition. Well, I worked on presidential campaigns between 92 and 2000 and 2004. Loved the work. Feel like it was very important. But you know, I can tell you on both sides of the aisle over the last few years, if I hadn't gotten out, it certainly would lead me to drink the political situation over the last few years. So now it seems like I got out just in time. I think politics, at least when I was doing it and you always wanted your candidate to win. You always wanted but you didn't necessarily want the other guy to lose, or at least you always felt like you had the best interest of the country, and there was always on both sides. I think as I grew up in Washington D.C., so kind of got politics in my blood, and growing up with people that really were statesmen and stateswomen that really had the good of the country in mind, and I loved the work and enjoyed it a great deal, but. Boy, I'm sure lucky that I made the transition over into wine.
Yeah, oh, without question. I mean, the volatile atmosphere of Washington D.C. seems like it would drive anybody crazy. Now, since you were in Washington D.C., and I'm going to get off the subject of of what you do now, the vines, but I understand that. They would bring in wines from different wineries around the country for events in Washington, D.C. Is that true?
Yeah, they do. Well, they certainly did it in the White House and also in the House and Senate, kind of like anywhere else in the world. I mean, that they people like to try great wines.
No, well, I heard that they would always, you know, try to feature even small wineries from around the country and stuff like that. And so that's good to know that wasn't just an idle rumor. It's true. That makes me feel better about that.
Absolutely.
So back to the vines. What does it cost? You say you have 1,500 members or something like that. What does it cost? 1,500 acres, 185 owners, to get into this. I mean, if someone wants to become part of the vines, what do they need to do?
Well, there's two options. If someone wants to own an actual piece of land, have a title to a piece of land that we can farm on their behalf and make wines in Mendoza, then that is starts at $100,000 per acre and goes down with volume. And then for members of the Vines Membership Club, our international expansion where we make wine all over the world. That is similarly $100,000 initiation fee, and that enables you to make wine at all of our different sites, the 8 sites we have today and our future sites.
Okay, now you say able to make wine. Do you have to own an acreage or a rows of grapes or something at all the locations?
No. And on the club, you once you're a member, that you can make wine at any of the sites around the world, whether it's Champagne or Montalcino, Priorat, Napa, et cetera.
Oh, cool. So once you get your initial membership, then that gives you the freedom to do your blend anywhere then that you have vineyards.
Yeah, and that's pretty most people will rotate around. They might make a Brunello 1 year and then a Napa Cab the next, and then maybe a Champagne and rotate it around.
Oh, well, that's cool. And then is there other costs? I mean, you make a wine, do you then have to pay for bottling and corking and capsuling and labeling and labor to put everything in the bottle and all that stuff? Or is how does that work?
Yeah, all of the – yeah, but depending on the region, it varies, but it's as low as $6,000 for a custom barrel of a really nice basic Riesling in the Mosel, and it ranges up from there, and that includes all of a custom label. So we work with our marketing department to create your own a name for the wine and a custom label and custom capsule and all of those things and ship it out to your house.
Now, I know the United States does, and a lot of countries do. You have to have labeling approved and stuff like that. Because of this concept,
yes,
it's not being sold to public. Do you have to get approval for all that?
Yes, we go through the TTB and get everything approved.
Oh, you still do? Okay. Even though it is private use, you still have to get approval on that?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't think you would. You end up doing a barrel, and that's what you get out of it, which is what approximately 25 cases. Can you trade with people within the system? Like, I made 25 cases of, say, a Willamette Valley Chardonnay, and I want to trade with someone in the Moselle for some of their wine. Part of the system also?
Yeah, many of our members will trade some of their wines for others, and especially in the early going when they may only have wines from one or two different regions. I think over time, most people will make wine at all the regions, so they'll have their own wines from everywhere. But between now and then, a lot of folks do trade.
And also, though, I guess when you trade, it's going to be their special blend, so it's not going to be duplicated. That's going to be it. I mean, just, you know, whatever they have, it's going to be the one-time thing of the 25, approximately 25 cases, so... That's an interesting approach.
It's unique in the unique in the world.
Yeah, I know. That just it really makes that for a great concept on that. Now, if people are blending, and I'm trying to understand all this. Say I own acreage in Mendoza, and I want to make wine in Germany. I go there and I do the blends and all that myself, or is there ways that you can circumvent having to travel over there and do it, or how does that work?
Certainly with COVID, it's been challenging to travel over the last 18 months or so, and so we do often do virtual blends where we will send the base wines to one of our members' homes and do a Zoom call with the winemakers so that they simultaneously are tasting the base wines and they can blend together. So it's certainly possible to do it, but a lot of the magic of creating the blend is being there in the winery with the team and tasting the wine together. And of course the dinners and lunches and cultural activities, whether it's truffle hunting in or a pasta class in Italy, or going crabbing in Oregon, or hiking through the mountains of the Andes in Mendoza. So there's a lot to be said for getting on the plane and actually getting to know the land. And you were also, so much of a wine is, of course, not just the liquid. It's the terroir in every sense of that word. Of course, the soil and the water and the sun and all of that, but also it's the people and the place. And I think so much of the appreciation of wine comes from understanding the people who make it, the place it's made, and you understand why certain wines from certain regions are there, and you see why it matches with the food. And a brilliant bright Albarino in Spain when you're having some shellfish is fantastic, and then you're having a boar ragu in Tuscany, and you understand why Sangiovese is such a good match for that. I think that cultural understanding and that sense of place understanding is a big part of what we try and give to our members.
Sounds like a great concept. Now, I was thinking too, the movement now in biodynamics and sustainability and all that stuff is so big. Do these wineries go by any special concept or any special growing techniques that put them do they use any of that stuff?
The truth is that our winery partners, because we seek that out, but really almost all really, really high-end wines are made in a very organic, very sustainable. They may not subscribe to all of the biodynamic philosophies about when they prune and do some of those other things, but it's a natural, wine is a natural product, and it's
right.
And it's growing. And if you're out in the vineyard, and you see the impact of chemicals, and you could get some short-term gain probably, but if you're in it for the long haul, and most of our folks have been doing it for decades, if not generations. I mean, the Drapiers have been growing wine in Champagne for eight generations. And, when you look at wine as a very long-term thing, it's crazy not to be organic. So, they don't necessarily call it organic, right? And many of them don't have it, certified, so that they've got a sticker on the back of their label. But when you talk to them about it and you talk about how they farm, they don't want any nasty chemicals get in the middle of their wine.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point too. And I think most wineries are that way. They try to keep it as clean as they possibly can. And I think a lot of times the organic certification is just a formality that they don't want to go through and don't want to mess with. And so they don't, and let's go with that. Excuse me.
Yeah, I think increasingly people will do it. I mean, certainly consumers are changing things. And I can tell you when I first went to Mendoza and we first started growing 15 years ago, most of the quote organic wines, the ones that were certified, the ones that had on label, were not that good. And I think that part of it, you had to kind of figure out, they were kind of, it was a novelty, not necessarily that it was quality. And over time, we realized that it's important. And the consumers are demanding. I mean, lots of people are driving it. So I think you'll see more and more wineries advertising the fact that they're doing it, even though they've been doing it for a while.
And I think that's a very good point, because a lot of them, I've talked to wineries over the years, and I ask them if they are certified organic or if they do any of that, and they say, well, actually we do, but the certification process is rather difficult and time consuming in itself, and so they don't do it, but yet everything is there that they need to become certified as organic or any number of other certifications. So, a good point. The membership. You mentioned a lot of stuff that they do there. Is that an ongoing thing? I mean, these the hikes and the trails and the dinners and all that stuff, is that all expanding all the time and all part of the basic membership?
Yeah, so every year we're at each of our partner sites at least once and oftentimes twice a year. And so we'll go and as a group, and typically we'll have about 20 or 25 of our members go to the Mosul or to Napa for 3 or 4 days of tastings and dinners and blendings and hikes and the like. So those are kind of the formal organized pieces of this. But sometimes the travel schedule of our members doesn't match that. And so if they want to go to Champaign or to Mendoza and blend on their own, then that's a possibility. We arrange that as well. And then we also host a lot of other tastings throughout the U.S. and in Europe and in major cities where people can come and get together and drink wine and spend some time with the other members. One of the things that we realize is that while the actual blending of the wine and that cultural experience, the curated experiences when we go to those places is really important, the community has become really valuable part of the program for many members, and they've developed friendships. And so when we get together, they may have met on a trip to Priorat in Spain, but then when we do a tasting in New York or Chicago, they're able to get together and connect and share and trade some wines. So it's a nice way to keep that connection going all year long.
Oh, it sounds great. Where are most of your members from? I mean, is the United States the majority of them, or is it Argentina? Where?
The majority are from the U.S., but we've got a good number in Europe and also Brazil is a good market for us.
Oh, well, Brazil. I don't know why that surprises me. It shouldn't, but it does. Another thing I was going to ask, what about you? Do you have certifications, anything? Have you pursued that? Obviously, you're knowledgeable, but have you pursued the testing to become anything else, sommelier testing or any of that stuff?
No, I haven't. I don't have any formal wine education. My education is by doing and by I make I made 9 wines in Mendoza last year. I also made a Brunello and a Napa Cab and a Pinot Noir in Willamette and a Riesling. So I'm making wine all over the world and learning from the masters. So it's like our members. It's learning by doing. I think that's true for many, many winemakers. I mean, there are certainly many that have gone, the newer generations have gone to schools, but especially some of the older generations, they didn't go to enology school. They learned by trial and error and learning from their parents or somebody else that taught them.
And that's just the way I learned too. I don't have, any formal education. It's just by doing and, very good mentors and stuff like that. So I understand that completely. I think that's a great way to do it. There's something else. Oh, geez. We start talking and I start thinking of other stuff and I forget my question in there. Okay. So, Mike, do you have any comments or questions or anything for Michael here?
Not at this time. Just enjoying the show and taking notes as usual. I appreciate it. Thank you, Bill.
No. So if someone wants to get a hold of you, if someone wants to become part of the Vines, what is the steps that they take? Who do they contact? How do they contact you? And what is required of them?
Well, a great place to start is our website, which is the-vines.com, the-vines.com. You can also reach me at Michael at the-vines.com. com. Typically, for people that are interested, we do a phone call and talk to them a little bit about the membership and how it works, and really, it's for us to get a sense of what are the type of wines that they like, and what are the type of wines they typically drink, what kind of wine that might they drink on a special occasion, are they more Burgundy or Bordeaux, are they Napa, you know, where are their passions and tastes lie. And then for people that want to know a little more, oftentimes we'll put them in touch with another member so they can get a member's perspective on the club and the experiences. And then we have oftentimes during these trips, we set aside a couple spots for people that are interested to actually go on one of these trips. And so in October, well, in September, we'll be going to Montalcino. In October, we'll be going to Vermoso and Priorat. And we've got a couple spots at each of those where people will, guests will come and spend a weekend with the other members and with the winemakers and have a really hands-on experience with the vines. And then they can decide if it's something that's worth taking the plunge or not for them.
Oh, I see. Okay, so guests can become part of it. If people want to join just the trip or stuff like that, they can without actually happen to be a member. So that's good. The-Vine, you say, is the website?
Yeah, The-Vine, V-I-N-E-S.
Okay. Okay, there we go. You know, it's it's an exciting concept. I really was quite surprised when I first received the email and started to read through this. I thought this was a wonderful idea, and I wish the best of luck to you. Any closing comments or anything you'd like to share with us?
No, I just think that you know, the wine world's a big world, and I think that you know, it's very easy to kind of get stuck in and drink the stuff that we like or the stuff that we've always been drinking. And so I just urge people to get out and try something new and push yourself a little bit. There's always another great region or a great wine out there to find. And you'd be shocked by the ability of actually making wine to improve your wine education and your wine appreciation.
Oh.
Because once you understand all of the steps that go into the wine making, then that next glass and every glass you drink after that really becomes all the more richer. So if you're even a little bit curious about it, give us a call and come visit us in Argentina or in Europe or in the States, and we'll drink some wine together and have a good time.
I noticed one other thing too. I remember one of the questions I was going to ask on this list here. Are most of the wines red wines, or do you have an equal share of whites that are being made?
We have more reds than whites, but we, of course, champagne and Riesling in the Mosel, and we make a beautiful Vino Bianchi in Italy, some Chardonnay up in Willamette, some really nice whites, kind of Rhone blend whites in Argentina, along with some Sauvignon Blanc and Torontes. So it's probably 70% and reds, but there's certainly plenty of white opportunities for people to love white wines.
Oh yeah, because there's some beautiful white wines out there. And I was just, you know, I was looking at the list of the countries, and it tends toward red a little bit more, and that's what I was wondering. So, Michael, thank you so much for taking your time tonight and joining us. It is a great concept. I hope people out there will get in touch with you and pursue
Real
this.
Pleasure.
It's a great thing, and best of luck, and go out there and find some more places that you can add to your winemaking partners, and maybe in a couple of years we can talk again, and you can tell us all the new ones that you have.
Will do. That'd be great. Thanks a lot, and you take care, and we'll talk and hopefully get to share a glass soon.
That sounds real good to me. Thank you very much for taking your time tonight.
All right. Thanks a lot. You take care.
Uh-huh.
Have a good evening.
All right. An interesting concept.
The-vine.com. So check it out. A lot of good information on there.
Thevines.com. CHE-VINES.com. And there it is, thevines.com. Oh, great. And all sorts of stuff. Who we are, the idea, regions, winemaking, experience, culture, sustainability is even on the website. Champagne, Mendoza, Montesino, Napa, Perot, Moselle, Willamette. Oh, everything's on here. So fantastic. So if anyone's interested, there is, again, go to the vines with a dash between the and vines.com. And it will pop right up with great pictures and information and everything else. So, fantastic.
Okay.
Interesting concept. So, thank you, Michael, for being with us tonight. We do appreciate it. And best of luck. That'll be fun. I'll make a note of this, and maybe in a couple of years we can – maybe in a couple of years we can get him back on again and see what new partners they've added and what they've done at that time. But it's great concept. All right. I have some news to pass on to you. We still got 20 minutes, and so that gives me time here to tell you a couple things. I was going to pass on some information last week to you, and we canceled the show because we had a storm go through, a lightning storm, which is a good thing I did, because at about a quarter past the hour, the lightning hit around here and it kicked off our power and the computer went down and everything, and it took me a little time to boot it back up and all that. So it's, we live in Florida, we have lightning. And so sometimes it is best to just go ahead and bite the bullet and just let it, do his thing, because we can't fight it. Although Mike did tell me something, we were talking before the show, that lightning has caused toilets to explode, which I thought was just wow. I guess if the computer shuts down, if the computer shuts down for a few minutes, that's not too bad. Much better than having the toilet explode.
I was thinking when I first heard it, because I heard it quite some time ago, that the story was full of crap, but these are coming from news sources. I mean, there's quite a few stories, and it all seems to be from 2019, and August 8th, August 9th, and one was from Florida. Maybe they all were, but I just looked at the headlines. Oh, Florida toilet explodes because lightning was down the street. Well, now what? Yeah, we were talking before the show. What, now you can't go to the bathroom in a thunderstorm? Come on.
Yeah, I know. Well, that would be horrible. Yeah. I mean, just, gosh.
What did he die of? You don't want to know.
we can... We can go on this or not. So we had to shut it down last week. So I gotta have something I wanted to tell you about here. Okay, I told you that Murphy Good Winery was offering a fantastic job. And you heard me mention it, a couple months ago, I guess it was. It said the Hillsburg Estate was offering a job that sounded too good to be true. It was a year-long apprenticeship at the winery, free accommodations in a vineyard-adjacent Victorian house, and a year's supply of wine. And the salary was $10,000 a month. And, oh my gosh. It said the job posting went viral. And the people just went crazy on it. But Veronica Hebbard, H-E-B-B-A-R-D, and another woman, beat out 7,000 applicants for the job, and they were the ones that got it. And it said that the two winners, Veronica Hebert was from Florida, yay for her, and a Lindsay Perry of Texas. Both of them are 28 years old, and they've never worked in the wine industry, and they just got Instagram accounts and got focused on wine a little bit more during the pandemic, and they applied. It says the $1,000 a month in rent-free living in Sonoma County, it just seemed like too good to be true, but the they are social media savvy, and that helped them land this job. So they are, it says, it's sort of an alternative way of paying for influencer marketing through the winery. And they said young drinkers should spend their time on social media and see a posting like this with, you know, 7,000 applicants. It really is more than you can even guess would be a possibility to get the name out there and get people to notice you. They said that let's see, parts of the campaign have felt more like a reality TV competition than a hiring process. The way that Murphy Good publicized flying 17 finalists to Hillsburg for a wine country weekend, and because as far as the publicity stunts go, this has been very successful, they said. The job campaign has made the brand a lot more visible and has led to stories all over the wine industry and even on mainstream TV shows. CNN carried an episode about it, and Murphy Good has done other things that they've had it published out there in all sorts of different media accounts, and even YouTube has stuff, so you can look it up on YouTube if you're interested in seeing some of the finalists and some of the stuff that they did for this campaign. And it says that it's significant that both of the winners are women, a demographic that Murphy Good hasn't always appeared to be reaching out to as customers. It says much of its branding in the past seemed to have targeted men because of their advertising and postings about grilling, golf, tailgating, and especially hashtag wine like a man campaign that they did. So it is settled. It's too late for you to join it. You can't do it now. They've already got their winners. At $120,000 for the year, the salaries will be significantly higher than the average California winery worker who earns only about $40,000 annually. But it's the publicity that they got from this has far outweighed the cost that it's going to cost them. And they can't really measure all the publicity that has been generated from this. And they've done it before. They've done it in the past, but I've never seen a follow-up on it like this. So this is a good thing. This is actually out of the San Francisco Chronicle, which is down the street, I suppose you can say, from Napa. And so it's a good thing.
Out that Veronica from Florida is a project controls specialist at Walt Disney Imagineering in Orlando, Florida. She's got a Master of Engineering, Master's of Engineering, Engineering Management from Rochester, Bachelor of Science in Industrial and Systems Engineering out of Rochester Institute of Technology also. So Yeah, quite a bit there.
But nothing in wine.
No, there was. What was this article here? Something else. She received scholarships to complete her. What's the WSET? WSET, I guess it is.
Yeah.
Level one and two.
Oh, did she?
Wine Unify. Yep, through Wine Unify and the Roots Fund in 2020 and 2021, respectively. So she's looking to add her diverse voice to the climate, ever-changing climate of the wine world. And, yeah, so I forgot what this was. PRNewsWire.com has an article on both of them. And let's see, I'm trying to find Lindsay. What was that, Lindsay? Oh, Lindsay was – okay.
Yeah.
It would help if I'd read the name. Lindsay is currently lives in Austin, Texas. She's the one that received scholarships to complete her level one and two. Sorry about that. Veronica will be making her way to Sonoma by way of Orlando. Currently works as an engineer. They don't say where it's from, but we found out because we're investigative reporters here at All About
Wine.
Yes,
we are.
And,
yes, we are.
but no, I don't see anything kind of trying to skim through this to have any kind of wine background. But Lindsay Perry, originally from Pennsylvania, yes, she's the one who did get scholarships to complete her level one and two through Wine Unify and the Roots Fund in 2021. So got that straightened out.
Hard to say that they... it says here in the article that they no knowledge of wine at all. I didn't mention that she had already gotten level one and two in her Winsett certification. I'm sorry, I was reading, and it's hard to talk about something else when you read.
Alive and unprepared, and it's like, darn it.
Yeah. So, yeah, they, but it's, it's a Hardy Wallace. Hardy Wallace from Atlanta uses extra Delta Award models to fly into San Francisco to be first in line at the Help Wanted booth for Murphy Good in 2009. And it says he puts a sample of some Verde wine. Okay, Hardy Wallace was the winner in 2019. After winning the contest, he was a former wine blogger, and he started his own wine label, Dirty and Rowdy. So Hardy Wallace was the winner of 2019. Murphy Good's been doing this for 2 or 3 years, I think. I think they skipped in 2020 because of COVID. 2020 is like a non-year for the world. Hardy Wallace was the winner in 2019. So, and then a double winner in 2021, two girls. So interesting. So, you know, all of you people who heard that and said, oh, okay, you should have applied because you never know. You could have been a winner. And so it's just, I know. Not bad. And get the apprentice. I mean, wine. You could take a month's pay and join the Vine and start making wine all over the world.
Months of
help. That's all it takes.
That's right.
So, let's see. I've got a couple of other things to talk about here before we are done. Yeah, we got 8 minutes. I can squeeze in a little bit more news here. Let's see. Let me look at my list here. And this is not what I wanted, I don't think. Grapes and herbicide drift. Sudden vine collapse. We talked about that once, and I will follow up more on that because that's something that could affect everybody anywhere. If they don't find out what it is and what's causing it, in California right now, but patches of vine just stop growing. They say it's not a single pathogen. It's just a combination of stuff, and a section of vines just die. Get a group of grapevines that are next to each other or around each other, and they die. So it's a something that is a little bit scary and a little bit, don't know what's going to happen with it, and they don't know the cause of it. They don't know the reason, which is really one of the worst things about the whole thing. So, let me see. What is this? This is, okay. And yeah, highlighted this. Let me see what this has to say, because I highlighted it for a reason. Ah, the fires, the burning question. California, the fires are going crazy again, and they're saying that what's the name of the current one? All I can think of is the Glass Fire, and that was last year. But this current one is approaching the possibilities of being the biggest fire ever. It's now in second place, and it's approaching being the biggest fire ever in California. So far, it has avoided some major areas where there are vines, although it has burned towns to the ground. But it's not affected vines directly, but the smoke in the air is something that is concerning everyone. The smoke taint, when the glass fire, that's what it is. Smoke taint is something that is going to affect the grapevines because the smoke is just hanging in the air, especially when the fires go over valleys, and it just causes the smoke to hang over the valleys, and it will affect the grapevines. And the sad thing, and we've talked about smoke taint, you really can't tell right away, although there are tests that are being done, and they're finding out more and more about how to really test it to be sure that there's no smoke taint in the grapevines. But it's they're backed up. The labs that are doing this are backed up. There's so many want to do it, and we're getting toward the time of year that hopefully grapes are starting to form, and harvest season is getting close. Verizon has occurred, and it's usually about 6 weeks after Verizon that they start picking, and Verizon has occurred all around Northern California now, slowly, but you're starting to see it pop up everywhere. And because of that, the grapes figure about 6 weeks after Verizon, they become ready to harvest, and the glass fire is still going through the areas and all that, not affecting the grape vines directly, but the grapes and the smoke. And so it's an issue. Last year, a lot of the buyers of grapes from the growers refused to buy them because of smoke taint, which cut back on the supply, which also cost the growers who count on those sales. It's just like a mushroom effect. And so the fire is not just something that's going to affect area. You see the towns burn down and stuff like that, but it has a continuous effect on the grapevines and different things. They talk about the glass fire here. You know, Yeah, that was the other fire. But there, it's they said that Napa wine alone injects about $34 billion. That's with a B. $34 billion into the U.S. economy. And so when you have microclimates and stuff that are being affected by these fires, that starts dipping into that. And that is scary stuff, you know, and I mean, really scary stuff. And, you know, it affects the cost of the areas too. And it affects, oh, just the whole thing. So anything that you can think that might be affected by these fires, it probably will be. It's just, it's a scary thing out there with these fires. So that's what that is. Let's see. Supreme Court is being petitioned on wine shipping. I mentioned this earlier. California, Sarasota actually, Sarasota Wine Merchants is suing Missouri for their, well, Schmidt is what the suit is, but Sarasota Wine Markets versus Schmidt. And it's that that Florida cannot ship wines to Missouri customers, even though Missouri shops can ship wines to Florida and to Missouri customers. And so Sarasota Wine Merchants is suing, and it's supposed to be appearing before the Supreme Court, and they're asked to be intervened. The Supreme Court doesn't like to answer these questions, but they're going to have to on this one, because lower court ruled in favor of Missouri, and then Sarasota, wait a minute, that's not right, because the Supreme Court just ruled that they can't do that. And so they're basically, lower courts ignored the Supreme Court and did whatever they wanted there. So now the Supreme Court has to rule again. It's continuous stuff on this, and, you know, just all exciting stuff all the time. And see, there's one other thing. And this is again with smoke damage. Northern California, North Coast wine grape smoke damage is heading to the courts. They're trying to figure out a restraining order on selling wine and juice because they say it's smoke damage. And the question is, I have a contract. They cannot refuse it because of my contract. They have to pay so much anyway. And so it's a dispute there of what's going to happen. Like I just mentioned, the implications to all the growers and then even to wineries, what are they going to do? I mean, if you make me buy this from you and it's tainted with smoke, I can't sell it. And so therefore it starts becoming, yeah, problems. So ongoing thing with the fires out there in California, it's even more ongoing, it seems like, year after year, and around other areas. It's not just California. It seems like the west side of the Rockies is burning up. There's fires all over the place. I read somewhere that there's 400 active fires as of Thursday. As of Tuesday, I read that there are over 400 active fires in the western United States. Oh, boy. I mean, it's just, whoa. Okay. So that's it. It's 8 o'clock. I was able to tell you some more stuff there. Let's see. Is there anything else? No, Chianti is changing a bunch of rules. So that's something we can look forward to. Chianti's getting a little bit more tighter on their rules and their what they can call Chianti. And I think I mentioned too that Russia put a clamp on champagne name Champagne. Russia says you can't ship anything into this country with the name Champagne. And Champagne is saying, wait a minute, that's our name. And they're saying, nope, we use it here in Russia and we can't ship anything. You got to stay sparkling wine. So that is another thing that the international courts are looking at. And they're saying probably Russia's going to win because they're within their own country and all that. So that's something else that's going on to informed on that as news comes through the wires. So there we go for this week.
I did look up the California wildfires. The Dixie Fire is the second largest fire in state history with over 463,000 acres that have burned. It ignited on July 13th. The number one spot goes over to the August Complex Fire that consumed more than 1 million acres in 2020, and that's the number one spot. So they're kind of ranking their wildfires, even though there's so many of them out
yeah.
there. The Dixie Fire is the second largest that you were talking about. And it started recently, July 13th. Wow.
And it's only like, what, I think 40% contained. Last I read, it's less than 50% contained. So it still has a chance to burn a lot more.
As of August the 8th, they have 21% contained, according to Cal Fire.
And today's the 19th. I read, I don't know, Monday, I think it was, Monday or Tuesday, that it was like 42% contained. So it still has a lot to go before they get that under control, and that's going to be burning more. So it's serious stuff out there. Just hope it stays away from towns and all that. It's burned towns to the ground. It just goes through and just... And that's it. There's nothing you can do to stop it either. If they just start cleaning out the brush and all that and doing controlled burns, but they don't anymore. I waxed poetic about that a couple of weeks ago, but it's true. They need to do controlled burns and start cleaning out the underbrush and all that. But as long as the firefighters are going to be fighting the real fires almost year-round now, we are sad to say, then they're not going to be cleaning out that underbrush. And so, all right. I lived in California. It's sad to see stuff like this happen. It really is. It's sad to see an area that was all green and lush and everything, and then you go and look at it 3 months later, and it's burnt to the ground. There's nothing left but just burnt tree trunks and stuff. So,
it almost looks like a planet or something, someplace we haven't been to, some kind of planet out there that, you can just imagine what the landscape would look like. I don't know. It's just odd.
You're right. Yeah.
Sure. August 26th will be our next show. That's Thursday, the 26th at 7 p.m. Eastern time in the U.S. It's 8:07 now. We'll go ahead and close the show. Thank you all for tuning in.
We want to thank Michael one more time for taking the time out and joining us on the show tonight. If you all want to check him out, go to the-vine.com. Very simple, very easy website. So, and check that stuff out.
The Vine.
Not S, just the Vine. Okay.
Abby S. Okay, we'll get it. Sorry about that. We'll get it right. All right. Go ahead and head out. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks again. And have a great
week. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See you next week.
Yeah. Next week.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
remove, go to the